Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Chemed Podcast, brought to you by the Chemetic Means of Production. I'm your host, Robert Bishara. Today's very special guest is Ashraf Fouad, an Egyptian composer who teaches composition and theory at the American University in Cairo, AUC. He graduated from the Academy of Arts in Cairo and the Juilliard School of Music, where he advanced to DMA studies with David Diamond. Recent performances of Fouad's music have occurred in Cairo, Alexandria, Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York, Dublin, London, Vienna, and Budapest, among others. Awards for his works have come from the Kennedy Center, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, and the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Welcome to the podcast, Ashraf. How are you?
Hi, and thank you, Robert. Great to see you.
Same here. And thank you for joining me today. Let me begin by saying that I have learned so much from you. At AUC, my major was theater, but my minor was music. I took many courses with you on music theory and history, and I learned how to appreciate classical music from you. So I will eternally be grateful to you for
I am impressed by you, Robert, and
that.
And seeing
Thank
you
you.
as a well-established scholar, in that part of the world, and
Thank you.
everywhere.
Thank you. That's very sweet. And I have to add that you always supported me and my music. So I'm not exaggerating when I say you are an excellent teacher. So I learned how to carefully listen to music from you and how to write music criticism of live concerts, things like when to even applaud, you know. Not to mention that when you introduced us to minimalism, that blew my mind. And I've been influenced as a composer by Philip Glass and Steve Reich, particularly ever since. So I'm talking about 20 years ago. So, in any case, let's begin at the beginning. And I want to ask you, how did your passion for music start? What kind of music did you listen to growing up? And what made you decide to study music composition at the Academy of Arts in Cairo?
Well, I wanted to be a musician since I was crawling, maybe 3 years old. And I watch instrument. The instruments grabbed my attention when I was a little kid. When I watch on TV those musicians, and they were playing, they're not playing classical music. They were playing behind, regional classical singers like Abdul Halim, Hafez, Umm Kulthum. So it was always the instruments, the musicians hold that attract my attention, you see, to the extent that I would get two drawers and try to imitate the accordion and go like this. Drawers, you see, I take two drawers from the desk and try to imitate that. And then when I went to school, I started learning music, and I started teaching when I was 11 years old. I taught my
Wow.
classmates, because I was very into the technical element of music. How is it written? How do you write ta-ra-ra-ra-ra-ra-ra? That was fascinating to my mind. So I had this urge of learning how to write, how to put the circle on the staff. So the things, the very, very little things I learned, I wanted to teach the surrounding. I wanted to teach my classmates in grade, well, grade 5, grade 6. And that was the beginning. And then I grew up in that field.
So did your family introduce you to music, or how did that happen?
They encouraged me when they found this. They were very supportive. My dad was supportive, and he told me stories about he had musical instruments in his hometown. And but at that time we only had a piano at home, and the piano was my mother's piano, not was my dad. Even though he claimed that he had a guitar and a oud when he was a child. My father was an engineer, so mechanical engineer. And And my mother was in her youth, she was a concert pianist. She played in front of King Farouk.
Wow.
Yeah, in 1948, 49, something like that. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and she's the one who appointed Juilliard to me. She said, "Well, you should go to New York and Juilliard." I said, "What Juilliard? What is that?" She said, "Well, just go to Juilliard. This is your, your final frontier." So, and also there was one question I always had when I was studying at the academy: what happened to classical music? Who's writing classical music now that you mentioned Philip Glass and Stephen Reich? And the minimalism, also impressionism before that. And you see, I always wanted to know what happened after Beethoven and Brahms. That period ended by finishing the bachelor degree at the Academy of Art. I said, well, and then what happened? I want to know what happened after Brahms. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then destiny brought me to New York after that. Yeah.
I think there's the story of so one of my favorite composers is Frank Zappa, and he was influenced by Edgar Varèse.
Sure.
He talks about listening to Edgar Varèse as a kid and calling him, and there's a famous quote by Edgar Varèse that had a big influence on him. The present day composer refuses to die, and he also loved Zappa talking about how exciting it was to be a composer in the 20th century, like with in the context of modern music especially.
Yeah,
So that
yeah.
must have been amazing too for you to come to that realization, right?
That's true. That's true. Varese is a very dear composer. He's very special. Yeah, and very influential. He's one of those like Schoenberg and Alban Berg Weber. So you cannot mention these names without acknowledging Varese. Yeah, also
Yes.
wonderful.
So what kind of music were you listening to growing up? I'm guessing a mix between, like, I want to know the influence of Arabic music, for example, on you as a composer.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I had some music activity in Cairo, you see. So I played, I joined bands, and I created my own bands. And I wanted to have people perform my music. That's the reason I formed a band, so I can see my music played by others and sung by others. You see, there's a joy for this. Being a composer, when you write the notes down and then somebody in Wisconsin would play my music and I'm sitting in Cairo, and that was always leisure for me. Yeah. So I practiced, I played Arabic music, I composed regional songs in Arabic and in English. I remember one day, being a young kid, there was Mother's Day. I wrote my mother a song. So I said, well, this won't cost me anything. So I just hold the guitar and write. And then at that age, I was just learning the language. So I had the dictionary next to me and I said, a love song with my mother. And I put these English sentences because I wanted to sing in English to my mother. I was like 9 years, something like that, or 10 years. And I'm gonna, love song with my mother. So, you see, and I played the guitar and I sang this on Mother's Day, and that was my gift.
Oh, that's
So,
sweet.
yeah. And the fascinating thing, it's in English, and it's not my tongue, and I didn't even speak English at that time that well. I was just learning in school, you see.
Yeah, so you were attracted to that even from early on.
Yeah.
And so you were playing the guitar growing up more than the piano? Is that.
Yeah, I played the guitar, I played the keyboard. And you know, when you have friends that you like to be with, I played the guitar. So my friend, because my friend was playing the keyboard, and I wanted to play the keyboard, but because he was playing the keyboard, I said, well, okay, I'll play the guitar.
Okay. Right.
together. I really wanted to be the keyboardist, but he doesn't play the guitar. I play the keyboard and the guitar. So I said, okay, you play the keyboard and then I'll do the guitar so we can be together in the band.
And the reality of like people that love music is that they will experiment with any instrument that they find, honestly. So, right?
Absolutely.
It's just the nature of the profession, right?
It
But
is.
now I guess your main instrument, would you say, is the piano or
It is. Yeah. Even though when I, you see, I had my teachers at the Academy of Arts. I had Syed Awad as a teacher. I had Gamal Salama as a teacher. Gamal Salama is very well known in the region, who passed away. And I had Taha Nagy, my last composition teacher in Cairo. And then, we were using the piano and the music sheet. But when I went to Juilliard, I had teachers like Milton Babbitt, that grand Milton Babbitt, who just passed away a few years ago. David Diamond, and I had Stanley Wolfe. I had two Pulitzer Prize winners, Bernard Renz and Joseph Schwattner. Joseph Schwattner came to Juilliard from Syracuse.
So I wanted
And
to ask you actually about Juilliard because, sorry to interrupt, the most prestigious music school I believe in the world. Like if you don't mind telling us about your experience there.
I was about to say that because Juilliard is a whole world. And Juilliard, everybody is a musician. The doorman is a musician. The security is a musician. I think they examine these guys before they hire them. Because juror, they believe that who is they? They is goes back to Robert Schumann, the early president. He was the president of juror school during the 40s. This is where Juilliard was peaking and getting it's established. Juilliard was established was founded 1919 by Augustus Juilliard. You see, and 20 years later, it had Robert Schumann, the great American composer, as a president. You see. And he believed that musicians are not ordinary people. They are special. So they think differently. They speak differently. I hear a sound, Robert. You hear that sound, or that's here?
What sound are you hearing? Because I'm not hearing from my end any sound.
It's disappeared now.
Yeah, it's not coming through.
Okay, good. As long as our interview is not disturbed. You see, Robert Schumann is a very special president to Juilliard School, and he is the one who initiated this, like have the security person a musician, you see, and everybody you walk in Juilliard, they are all musicians, and because sometimes musicians act different, you see. We talk differently, and sometimes we make some unexpected moves, maybe, or different act. You see, we are not ordinary. So they have to, they have to absorb the students in a nice way and let them have their own space when they move around and when they talk and when they act strangely to normal people. This is normal to musicians, you see. So the year I joined Juilliard was the year Peter Menon died, a great American composer who is the president of Juilliard before I joined. The year I joined, 1981. And he died in 1981. He was he had a flute concerto that was too difficult to be performed, and he died with having this concerto performed. And the amazing thing, Robert, is You see, I learned this the first year I got to Juilliard, 1982. And after that, 20 years or more, 2004, I was in Lake Placid, New York, upstate New York. And I had a performance there, and I have a lot of friends in that area. So the late Logan, late Lake Placid is very special. It has those beautiful homes on the lakes. And guess whom I met in that gathering? I met Peter Menon's wife. The man who died in 1981, I met his wife. She was still holding, beautiful lady, strong, in 2005, 2000, yeah, 2005 or 2004. 2004, yeah.
So 23 years later or something like
23 years later, this
that.
lady met me and they introduced. I said, oh, we have a composer here who was, we went to Juilliard. She said, oh, I want to meet him. And I said, well, I know your husband very well. And I told her about the flute concerto. And she said, oh my God, you know about that? And she was flattered that I knew these stories about her husband. And she gave me pictures of her husband and scores and her both of them memories. And I saw that was a treasure, you see. Yeah, Juilliard is very special. And people who went to Juilliard, they're also special. Yeah, if you walk in the hallway and you meet someone to speak, there's a music lesson already there, you see.
It's fascinating what you shared about how everyone that works there
Really?
has a passion for music. Like that's unbelievable.
Administrative assistance. She was a singer and then she stopped. And then now she is a secretary in that place. Even Yeah, the lady who checked the IDs at the gate of the Juilliard School, she was an opera singer, but she had this accident, so she couldn't move.
Fascinating.
Yeah, normally, so she got this job at the Juilliard School. Ask anybody, they would have like a history with music.
So I imagine that it must have felt also competitive, like it was a nourishing environment full of music lovers, but also everyone loves music, and it's like I imagine it being also competitive at the same time,
True. Yeah,
right?
among all levels in the building, like workers, students, professors, administration, teachers, yeah, special teachers, like major teachers. So not classroom teacher, because when you study composition, you are with your teacher alone in the room, so one on one. That's different from ear training teacher. Your training, she is teaching 20 kids or 18 kids in the room, and they're doing ear training activity, recognizing chords. And hey, ear training at the Juilliard School, this is something amazing, Robert, you would hear. We read Bach chorale. I can show you. I can reach the book and show you.
Sure.
Just a second, right here. Yeah, this is the book. This is the book.
So that's a book that you were studying from Juilliard
I
years.
here and yeah, you see.
Wow.
Yeah. And also you see what we did? These four staffs, play three and sing one.
Okay.
Play three with you, sit at the piano, play and the one before, and sing the one in the middle, sing this, and play the other steps on the. Yeah, I would never forget Miss Cox. She was from Maine, Vermont, somewhere there, and she taught us ear training. I had there were two beautiful teachers, Miss Scott and Miss Cox. And both of them taught me ear training. And that was like a torture. And you see, look at this. Look at this analysis underneath.
That's not easy.
Yeah, you see the chords are written here. So while
Right.
you're playing, yeah, that's an assignment right here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pencil. Yeah, you see, this is done in ear training class at the
Well, that's why it's the best, because they're not
Juilliard.
gonna be easy on you, right? So I wanna share a joke with you, and then a Juilliard related question. So many people, when I say the name Zappa, will associate with, is more like rock or jazz music, but very little people, or very few people, know about him as a composer. So I was actually, I think yesterday, I was listening to Ensemble Intercomparant by Pierre Boulez performing some of his compositions. And yeah, and his music, he wrote this piece called The Black Page, which is a joke because obviously it too many notes, right? So that's why it's called The Black Page. And he wrote this piece first for drums, and then he added that's the Black Page number one, and then Black Page number two. He added other instruments, and it became more melodic. But it started out as a rhythmic piece, and because he kind of, grew up playing the drums first, and so he always wrote difficult drum parts in his work, which I think is fascinating. So here's my Juilliard. So I know Glass went to Juilliard as well, and he said that he learned more from studying one-on-one with Nadia Boulanger in France. Somehow that he had to have all the Juilliard training in order for her to deconstruct all of that and teach him to kind of think outside the box. And at first it was very frustrating, but then he got a lot of skills from her that were important for him later on as a composer. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that Nadia Boulanger is one of the historic teachers throughout history everywhere, and she taught so many American composers, and they all went to France to study with Nadia Boulanger. And I remember that there was a saying that is always talked about at Juilliard, that on every corner in the USA there is a McDonald's, Burger King, and a student of Nadia Boulanger.
That's a good
That,
one.
and you see, this is how many American composers were interested, and they were seeking to be her students. She was the harmony and counterpoint teacher at the Fontainebleau in Paris for so many years. And then later, so she taught like more than 100 American composers. So when she came to US to visit in late 60s, she was celebrated, and everybody wanted to have her, take her around. And there is a beautiful book on Nadia Boulanger's life. I had that one. And she was also driving around with, she was very excited driving stick shift. And she never changed the gear. So she was on gear for throughout the thing. And hey, Miss Boulanger, you have to switch the gear because she was so excited driving in New York. And is
That's
that
amazing that one person can have such an influence. But it also speaks to clearly she had some important insights that were missing, maybe from the American system. She was very tough on him. That's what I remember is that, and it kind of forced him to listen to music differently, and stand out from others, right?
She always criticized the melodic lines. She always asked the composer, "Why do you always go down? Why do you not go up?" You see, yes, I see a lot of composers have this tendency of going down. They take the line down,
Right.
and and they forget. Yeah, they go up after that, but they have tendency to go down. And she was aware of every little notion and move in the melody, and the melody is standing on the background, or the support of this melody, what's in the background. Do you know that Nadia Boulanger is the cause of having what's known as the American tone? And she taught Aaron Copland. Aaron
Wow.
Copland went to Paris in 1920, and he was one of her students. And she told him, you have to find a tone for yourself, and you have to learn about your heritage so you can find the missing American tone, you see, because before Aaron Copland, there was McDowell in the second half of the 19th century who studied in Germany. But when you listen to his music, it's German, you see. So he lost
Right.
The flavor of his heritage. Yeah. So he's.
That's a really good point. That so in a sense, she one of her teachings is to listen critically and not kind of repeat cliches as a composer, but like find an original style, original voice, right?
Absolutely. And by the way, this is you find that in Glass music, because he found his own tone. So do you want to be another Beethoven? No, of course you don't want to be another. And you don't want to be a Mozart, and you don't want to be a Philip Glass. And well, Philip Glass is there, you see. What
Right.
do I do? I become another Philip Glass, a copy, you see, a copycat.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm very mentioned Nadia. You brought Nadia Boulanger to our conversation, Robert.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And so I know that you've been teaching at AUC, I believe, since 1994, correct? Is that the date?
I've been here for 30, almost 30 years next year.
Yes, so that's fascinating. What is your philosophy as a music professor?
Yeah, my philosophy is believing in the talent and the intelligence of my students. I know that my students can move mountain if they have this urge, and they could do it, you see. So this is how I see my students, and I even have this is a new folder that I'm in. So there was that was not there when you were at AUC.
Yeah,
these fancy folders. Yeah, trying to find. Yeah, because you see, I wrote in my syllabus my teaching philosophy that I can share with you if you want to. But this is it. This is it. Briefly, this is believing in the students' ability that they could do anything when they put their mind into it, they can
Right.
do it.
What do you hope to teach your students?
What do you say it again, please?
What do you always hope to teach your students, like the important skills that you like passing on?
Yeah. You see, students are different. Yeah, if I stand in front of 20 people teaching, every one of them will learn something different from the others, you see. And as a teacher, I have this ability to know who is learning what. And I know that this person is sitting, well, just to get by that course. And but for example, when I have a special student and a talented student that deserves the attention and the support, like I had one many years ago, his name is Robert Bishara. Yeah, that is you. And it's interesting and fascinating that I saw in you a world-class musician. You see, when you were...
That's very sweet.
Because maybe you didn't see that at that time, but what I saw in this student, so this is another skill that a good teacher would have, you see. So I know that this kid can do a lot. And boy, the years go by, and this name is established, and you have accomplishments, fascinating and impressive.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you saying that. You know, like my passion for music is one of the most consistent aspects of my life. Like there are so many changes, but the passion, it just grows. It's like a fire inside of me. So I'm glad I met you as well. Who are the composers that have influenced you the most, and how would you describe your style of music as a composer to someone who has never heard your music before?
When I entered the Juilliard School, there was a big shock for me to become a contemporary contemporary composer. And to me, what's contemporary? You see, what was contemporary at that time? And because I was writing like Mozart, like Haydn, like Brahms. The latest to me was Brahms, and but still doing chords that have names like one, four, five, triads, seventh chord, 11, 13, all of that was done. But there are other things. There's freedom. You see, when I remember my first teacher was Stanley Wolf, who opened this door for me. I said, wow, now you can do anything. You can just hit any key and invent a chord of your own and build on that chord and resolve that chord to wherever you want to go. You don't have to resolve the dominant 7 to 1 and that traditional way of dealing with progressing chords. And that to me was like, it took me a while to absorb. I said, well, wait, that now I feel like I am sitting in the middle of the galaxy. I'm losing balance, you see. It took like a few months to get on the track of what is the significance and what is the meaning of contemporary music. You see, what do they do and what do I follow? So you have to establish your own theoretical concepts and build on it. Yeah, and that was done. And Juilliard also, I was introduced to 12-tone music. You see, Arnold Schoenberg and Serialism.
Eric Satie.
Erik Satie and Alban Berg, Weber. And when I studied with Schwartner, he taught me something called pitch class set. So Schoenberg was doing 12 tones, 1 to 3 to 12, and a table of 12 letters here, 12 letters there. And I can show you if you'd like. But we don't want to get too technical, right?
I mean, it's as technical as you want to get, so I, you know.
Pitch class set was like, in other words, to make the long story short, I was exposed to a lot of ways of how to compose music, you see. And this way is this manner taught me that I can create my own way too. Compose music, you see. So there's not one way that we all follow, or that all composers follow. You have to establish your own in order to achieve what you how you want to sound. Another thing that my teacher told me, and that is Stanley Wolf, the first teacher at Juilliard School, he said that you cannot escape your heritage. And that word I never forget. So if whether you're writing contemporary, you're writing classical, you're writing romantic, you're writing crazy stuff, avant-garde music, you are there. Your breath is in the music, and your blood will be in that music. So you cannot even escape that.
Even if unconsciously, right? The Egyptian tradition, the Arabic music tradition, is very rich, and it's like inside of you. So even if you're not thinking of it consciously, it's still somehow an unconscious influence in terms of like the scales that are popular in Arabic music, or the melodies, or the rhythms, etc.
I agree with that too, right?
Absolutely. I actually find myself, like when I think about writing music, I think like you in a free way. I don't think I'm gonna write in this style. But then if I'm like, let's say, improvising a line on the piano or something, I usually go to sort of Arabic music scales and rhythms and melodies, and that kind of gives it a little bit of a unique flavor that's missing here, in the US or the West. So that we have something unique to contribute as well as composers from Egypt,
Yes.
which actually relates to my next question. I remember that you shared with me an experimental composition focused on the work of Egyptian singer Umm Kulthum. I
Yeah.
believe it was called "Look at Me While Listening," correct?
Wow, how do we know that?
I remember because you shared it with me when I was a student.
Wow.
Yeah. So, can you tell us more about this very interesting piece from 2003, I believe. So that's 20 years ago.
Yes. That was a commission from the World Bank. There's a story behind this one, and there's very boy, Robert Bishara, you are boy, pointing things and putting your fingers on, wow, very important points in my life. I was in an exhibition in front of UR Tahoul and Tahrir campus, and there was this beautiful lady with long hair. That her hair was in the ground, and that was wow, very eye-catching. I said, well, I kept looking at her hair, and she was looking at the paintings, and I was looking around, and then we were introduced to each other. Artist, she's an artist, a Pakistani American artist. Her name is Mansoura Hassan. We just hooked chemically, and she said the reason she's in Egypt, her husband is the World Bank representative for this nation. So he is serving a term of 3 years or 4 years. That's why she's here. And while she is here, if she is in a place, she is always active. This lady, when she was in Egypt, she founded an organization called Friends of the Opera. Was at one of the founders. She invited me as a founder of this, and after that, yeah, she gave me this commission for World Bank. She said, "Well, we would like you to do something for us, so create a piece that would be exhibited." And then she said, "Exhibited in an exhibition by a group of international artists." I thought of Kulthum statue that was made by Mahmoud Mukhtar, the Egyptian sculptor. He did this statue in 1928 of Kulthum, and then after that he died. And that was also a part of a production by Waleed Aouni, this director at the Cairo Opera House for modern dance. I attended this performance, and I was inspired by Waleed Aouni's introducing that statue on the stage. So I talked to the dancer who danced this piece, the part of Umm Kulthum in Waleed Aouni's production. Her name is Magdalene. Magdalene Nader, and I used her. I said, well, I want to do this. I want to write a piece of music, and I want you to move as a statue of Umm Kulthum, and I will have this as a piece of art, audio visual piece. And that was done, and it was successful. It was exhibited in Washington, D.C., in World Bank. And then right after that, they gave me another commission. They said, well, we would like to have another piece. And then I wrote something called Breathing Water, you see. Yeah. Breathing Water. And I also used I'd like to share that with you. Yeah, a bit of it. Yeah. So when we,
So it sounds like the idea was, what if the statue was animated and somehow the music that we hear is the statue coming to life, the statue of Umm Kulthum, which is a wonderful idea.
Yeah, yeah. And also the title of the piece is Look at Me While Listening, you see. So it's like an invitation to pay attention to me as a statue, as a representative of this artist, while listening to the music, you see. And I won't even give you a chance to listen to music, because the sound, there is a voice saying all the time things about Umm Kulthum in the
right.
piece. Yeah.
So I thought it was a very intriguing piece. And so
this woman, the way, Robert, to link things together, because that was Mansoura Hassan with this beautiful long hair, that she was like beauty. Her hair is, and then in 2016, she lost her son, and she cut that beautiful hair for to be about her son. Last spring, they said that Mansoura, she was living in Maryland. Mansoura is not feeling well. She's leaving. She's going. And then I said, well, I would like to write a piece for Mansoura, because we were preparing for an exhibition in Wisconsin, and the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. And I said, well, I'm dedicating this work called Ode to Mansoura, and I hope that she can join us. But she passed away while I was writing the first movement. If you hear of this work, it is going like fun, happy. And then in the middle, I heard that she died, and then I just translated that literally in the piece.
It's a break.
Yeah. In the middle, death.
Yes.
Yeah, something that will say something sad happened. And then
yes. The third movement. I was going to ask you about that later. I actually listened to the composition, which I thought was wonderful. But I have. And I wanted to ask you, you know, another thing you have in common with Glass, obviously both of you went to Juilliard, but I think when Glass was asked to sort of classify himself and what he does, he said something like, I work in theater. I make music for theater, or something like that. So theater was a big part of his development as a composer, and thinking, of course, in terms of opera and et cetera. So I remembered vividly your work on A Man's a Man, the Bertolt Brecht play directed by Frank Bradley at UC. How do you feel about scoring music for theater or film? How is it different in your process than other compositions?
I love theater. Yeah. My always dream was to write an opera. Yeah, and I was almost there with my former colleague who passed away, Valerie Farag, very decussive. If you remember her or not?
I do remember her, of course.
Soprano, and she was a poet, and we collaborated on many songs. I wrote a lot of songs. I set her poems to music, and she sang them, and other singers sang them, and the songs were sung in Europe a lot. Yeah, theater is fantastic. Mentioning Philip Glass and his connection with theater, I love Philip Glass opera, especially the one that is based on our Egyptian culture, Ethnaton.
Yes.
Huge production, beautiful work. Philip Glass, I just happened to play this opera scene from the opera yesterday in World Music.
Wow.
I'm teaching class called World Music now. I'm teaching music in the Arab tradition, something that I never imagined myself teaching music in the Arab tradition, but 6 years ago I started teaching that
That's
course.
beautiful.
And this amazing that you have this memory about the play. I did do with Frank Bradley a couple of plays, Antigone, and
Yes.
Man is a Man, the one that you're talking about. And I love the depicting scenes into sounds and accompanying acting with sounds. He even had me act in A Man is a Man, I think.
That's what I remember. So I actually I saw this play a number of times, and it was one of the reasons I majored in theater.
Wow,
Because
it was like
I was so impressed, yeah.
really, I had me play in a bar where the soldiers are having fun and they come to have some hang out in the bar. So he said, "Well, who's going to be the pianist but you? You have to be that, and you can say a couple of sentences." So then I got engaged in the whole play.
No, he was great. I got to work with him a few times, so I enjoyed working with him. So you love working collaborating, especially with theater. And what about opera? So are you planning to write this opera, or how? I know it's yeah.
Libretto is by Valerie. She wrote this opera called King Faisal Street. This is the title of the opera because it's a very, very busy street in Cairo, and she always got scared to cross that side. See, this funny libretto between a kid who is living on the 18th floor on that side, and he is in love with a girl on across the street,
Oh,
floor number 15, and the problem was crossing the street to meet.
wow. That's a good one. I like that.
Great, vivid, great imagination. And she, the libretto is very cute. Maybe one day when I
One
have.
day.
I'll do it, sure. I started
I
in her life.
started working on it. So I remember also your 2005 composition, Dedication for Harp. I think it premiered in Oriental Hall, and I was there. The three movements were so captivating that actually the late Valerie de Casas Farag stood up and asked for a repeat performance, which took place. And I remember, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that moment because that was very moving.
Course, oh Robert, you are bringing, oh my God, very special. Man, my heart is beating now. Oh my God, yes, Dedication for Harp. I almost forgot that piece. Oh my God, and there was an encore after the
Exactly.
performance. Yes,
And
indeed.
that's rare, right? For a composer to experience like
Yeah, of course.
yeah.
Yeah, usually happen with the dead composers. But wow, not sure. This piece, the Dedication for Harp, was based on a poem that Valerie wrote, and the poem's name is the title of the poem was Dedication, and that was saying farewell to the ambassador of the Hungarian embassy in Egypt. So she wrote this beautiful piece, and then I said, well, this is going to be my topic. So also, as you said, Philip Glass is attracted to words and singing and theater. Yes, I also had this urge and this connection with words. So I read the words of this poem, and I tried my best to translate it to sound without being sung. unusual thing,
That's
yeah.
a beautiful piece, and I actually want to share with you a Valerie story, because I took voice class with her. When I took that class, I would always come early to play on the piano. And one time she came in and heard me play, and she asked me, "Are you a composer?" And that question was so validating. I said yes. To be recognized by someone who's a professional opera singer like her is like it meant a lot to me. And she said that composers play a certain way on the piano, and somehow she recognized that. And she, of course, talked about you after that, and talked to me about your composition. So that was a very special moment. I want to also share, as I mentioned earlier, you were supportive of me in my music. You would allow me to show my films and play my music in class, and it meant the world to me to have an audience react to it back then. And you understand this because you had this urge in you since you were young, so you understood that. I want to share a few memories, other memories with you. One time you took us to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. I don't know if you still do that. You
I
showed us
no more.
no more. You showed us the musical instruments used by ancient Egyptians. I thought that was fascinating. We would go around and look at that and talk about that. You also invited many notable guests like Fathi Salama and Ashraf Suilam. So I remember that very well. And Salama is one of my favorite composers too. And then with the Philip Glass, you showed us a video excerpt from Einstein on the beach, and I was mesmerized. It's like I didn't know that this was possible in terms of music. It was so hypnotic, and it
Wow.
was mind-blowing, because it showed me a new possibility for opera, like a modern approach focused on intriguing rhythms, right? So you never know when you show people what kind of effects it's gonna have, but let me tell you that that had a big effect on me.
Wow. I'm impressed, Robert. I'm touched, and I cannot find words to tell you that how special this meeting is to me. Yeah.
To
I'm
me
very
as well.
thank you very much for putting this together, Robert.
Of
Yeah.
course, it's my honor. There was a period at AUC when you were the program director for the Howard Theater, I believe. How was that experience of being able to curate shows, and that was a very vibrant time.
Yeah, really. Yeah, that also was gone. You know, the new campus is very different. The atmosphere in the old campus was somehow cozier. We were closer to each other and Howard. And even though we were in scattered buildings in Tahrir area, but it was very cozy. You see, I don't know. Somehow we were like a one thing. And Howard Theater was a place where the students can burst their heart out and do whatever they want to do. And if you want to paint, bring your paintings here and we will watch it. If you want to sing, come and sing and we will watch it. Yeah. Temari McCormick also was a very, very important person. Yeah. In Howard Theater. Yeah. Howard Cafe. Yeah. Yeah. And I was at that time also, I was the director of the music program of that during Valerie's Valerie's time. Yeah. Wow, Robert, this is fantastic. Wow, the
You know
time.
how Howard Cafe was also another big influence on me. So I mean, I ended up obviously doing shows and things there, but in the beginning, when I started studying at AC, they used to have once a week, I think on Tuesdays or something like that, 6:30, the Howard Cafe that you mentioned. And just for the listener that doesn't know, basically, the students were in charge, and they organize these events on a weekly basis where community comes together, and there's maybe music, there's a play, there's stand-up comedy, audience interaction. You never knew what was going to happen, and each week was different, but it was so inspiring for people to come together and experience something creative like that on a weekly basis. It was one of the most beautiful experiences that actually led me to study theater because I was like, well, these are theater students mostly that are doing this. So I'm like, I got curious. I was like, wow, I gotta study this.
Wow.
Yeah, so choreography is very important. What are your thoughts on the Egyptian Composers Project by the Cairo Guitar Collective? They performed and recorded your three movement piece, Tre Angoli, which is
Yeah.
beautiful.
As a matter of fact, I have this is the piece. This piece was a commission by the Cairo Guitar Collective. They asked some composers around here, myself, there are two others who contributed. And my contribution was because their number, there's three musicians, three guitar players. Chelsea's from California, and Pavel Kuzma from Poland, and the other guitar players from Mansoura, Egypt, you see. So that was the idea of my composition. You see, I wrote a piece, L'Angola de Los Angeles, the first, and another movement called L'Angola del Mansoura, and the last one is L'Angola de Cilicia. Cilicia is the town of the third guitarist in Poland. So, the reason I called it Trianguli, three angles or triangle, because if you connect this with Egypt to Poland and California, there's a triangle right there. And I asked about, I requested some information about each one of them relation with their city, so I can absorb and then try to depict that picture.
That's a great piece.
Thank you. Did you hear it?
Of course, I've heard it multiple times.
My God, Robert, okay.
Yeah, and it's I think it has oud as well, in the Mansoura piece.
Mansoura one has you change the guitar with the oud, and then
You mentioned this earlier, but I want to go back to this. The Department of Music at the University of Wisconsin recently performed your Ode to Mansoor Hassan. That was earlier this year. Please tell us more about this piece. I know there's you said a little bit of the history behind it, but do you want to
This
say a bit more?
sure, because Mansoura was a very special person. We did a lot of projects together. You see, when I wrote in the past, like 22, 23 years ago, the piece that you mentioned, I'm very happy that you still remember that. Look at me while listening. That was the beginning of a long-term relationship and also a long-term membership with a bunch of great international artists. They are all painters, and they do colors paintings, well-established names: Betsy Stewart, David Carlson of DC, Richard Dana. And through this group, I composed my own music, and they put it on speakers, and they play it in the exhibitions, and sometimes they played it out loud. And Mansoura, one day, to make the work special, if you remember this big incident of 9/11 in USA,
Of course.
had me compose music for her videos. She put a veil on her and covered only her hair, and she walked in New York City, and she took videos, and she asked me to write music going with that video. So we had so many projects. She would take her camera and go to places unexpected, and she would videotape, and she would bring the video and said, "Well, I want you to write your reaction to that in music." So when this woman lost her son, she was deteriorating health-wise and everything. And then when I heard about that, I was a little bit annoyed, you see. And but now she, we the people who participated in these exhibitions, these names that I mentioned, David Carlson, and these names and other names, they're like 20 artists. We collaborated, we created a lot of work. We traveled to Turkey, we exhibited in Wichita, Texas, we exhibited in everywhere in Mexico, in Brazil, in South Africa, they took my music a lot with them, and sometimes I was able to attend, and other times I was not able to attend. I said, well, the least thing I can, you know, I just feel like I have to write something for Mansoura. You know, when the dean, when you were at AUC, we had a beautiful dean. Her name was Cynthia Nelson. She passed away. She was very special to me. I wrote a piece called The Elegy for Cynthia Nelson for solo cello. And Mansoura, I said, well, I'm going to write a piece called The Ode to Mansoura and three movements, an instrumentation of this. I contacted the music director of... the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. His name is Matthew Bushman. And we were in constant correspondence. Said, Matthew, what instruments should I, because I want to have a string, do you have a good string quartet in your department? Because this is to be played by students of the university. And I said, I just want to have some freedom in writing because I don't want to write a piece of music for students. So I have to watch for difficulties. I said, no, we have fantastic flute player, fantastic clarinet player. We have great string quartet. And that was it. I said, well, this is it. Sextet for flute, clarinet, and string quartet. And then I started working, and it was fine. They even contacted me when they rehearsed the piece. When I sent them the music sheets, they sent me videos of the rehearsals. And that was lovely to comment and tell them, you're doing fine. You see, I didn't really ask for the video. Kids, they just want to have some confidence, or are we on the right track? I said, your own interpretation, you're fantastic. Go on and continue. Yeah, they're great, great kids. Yeah,
that's the beauty too of music, is like you can compose a piece and then it could be interpreted in many ways depending who's playing, who's conducting, and right. Yeah. That's fascinating.
Really, really, really.
I'm almost, I have a few more questions. I know I'm taking a lot of your time. I want to be mindful. But do you have any thoughts on Halim al-Dabah, the late Egyptian composer who was one of the pioneers of electronic music in the world?
I invited him to AUC. I had as a guest when he was, he taught in Kent University in Ohio. And he is the one who composed the music of the Sound and Light Show in Egypt, in Luxor, and the pyramids. So if you anybody on earth would visit the great pyramids of Egypt or the Karnak Temple in Luxor, they will hear voices sharing the memory of these places with the audience. And these memories and these beautiful voices are grand voices worldwide. So I think actresses like Jennifer, the old Jennifer, near contemporary to Elizabeth Taylor, was one of the voices used in Sound and Light Show.
Wow.
And music of Halim al-Dabbah, you see. So that was an Egyptian composer. And when you hear the music, I said, oh my God, when I heard this before I went to USA, I said, well, did they hire a classical composer from Europe to do this music? Because very impressive. It sounded like, you know, wow, very, very special. And then later on, I found out that this is Halim al-Dabah, that legendary Egyptian composer. This composer is very special. Maybe he is the only Egyptian composer that got internationally acclaimed,
Yes.
internationally recognized by so many. There's not one dictionary of music without Halim al-Dabaa.
Yes.
Halim al-Dabaa is also who wrote the Sound and Light Show, taught Kent University, and I got it. I remember it was in my mind, and then I said, well, I don't want to forget it. Columbia University. Emory and Columbia University. World War II, 1945. In Columbia University, they were building the first computer ever. A huge room, and the computer, the machine was huge. In one room, you have all these things. Now we have everything in that instance.
The microchip, yeah.
The past, it was like a huge room
That was
filled
one computer.
one computer, and the
Yeah.
other room, it's like an audio studio where you can sit outside and the machine is inside the other room, and you can control it from the other room. Halim al-Dabaa was one of two people in Columbia University who had the key to that room.
Yes.
This is how Halim al-Dabaa is to education world and this special institution in New York, Columbia University, on the 125th Street. And see, he was trusted with the of that one computer in the USA in 1946,
So he was
1947.
one of two people that had access to this very special room. And you know, he's really recognized in the West, especially for his work in electronic music, because you know, he's one of the early
Sure.
people that experimented with those sounds. So that's fascinating too, that you wouldn't think an Egyptian composer would be a pioneer of electronic music, but here it is. The history is there. So I'm curious if you've seen the film Tar, by the way. Have you heard of that one with Cate Blanchett?
No, tell me about it.
So Lydia Tár is widely revered as one of the greatest living classical composers and conductors, and a tempestuous artist whose combination of ambition, ego, and hubris seems to know no bounds. And as she approaches a career milestone, her world unravels when the past finally catches up with her. So basically, it's a drama about this composer called Lydia Tár. It's supposed to be fictional, but probably inspired by true stories. But I think you would love it, just
Sure.
because it's a whole film about a composer slash conductor, and she there are scenes, I think, at Juilliard where she's teaching a class. There are scenes where she's conducting different orchestras in Germany and the U.S. and so it's a, you know, I want to follow up with you after you've seen it. So what music are you listening to these days, and what are you currently working on?
Right now, I'm in between compositions. I am doing a symphonic poem based on this last composition that you discussed, the Mansura, Auto Mansura, that was done by Sextet. Now I'm orchestrating that to an orchestra, and I'm calling it Symphonic Poem. And then in parentheses to Mansura Hassan. And another special thing is maybe someone that you remember. She was one of your classmates. Mary Edward is assisting me in orchestration because I'm very busy and I need to finish this because it's going to be played by the Cairo Symphony Orchestra next March.
Oh, wow.
I have to have this. So I, Mary Edward, thank God that Mary was my assistant in the past, and I taught her like I taught you theory and composition, and she is a very special student. And she is doing also a lot of charity work with Sudanese, Palestinians everywhere. Yeah, with a company that is Italian based. She took the piece, and we were going to have sessions on orchestrating this together. So she would show me what she did, and then we discuss her orchestration. And if I have suggestions, I tell her. And very, very healthy environment in putting this, in realizing this new composition. So I will give her full credit in the premiere in March, in Cairo Symphony Orchestra. This would be orchestrated by Mary Edward, music of Ashraf Fuad, orchestrated by Mary Edward.
Well, that's amazing, the recognition. And so you'll be busy basically from now till then, working on that piece and getting those sheets out to all the musicians. And okay,
Big.
so I want to end on something kind of intriguing and exciting. I want to share a piece of composition that I did called ENA, which is it stands for Egyptian National Anthem, right? So this is my variation on the Egyptian national anthem composed by Syed Darwish.
Wow.
And yeah, and this is like maybe from, just to give you a sense of when it was, this is maybe 12, 13 years ago.
My
But
God.
the inspiration behind it, it's Bledi Bledi, right? And
Sure.
I wanted to explore it, but like play with the harmony and do a variation on the piece. So I'm curious to know what
Please.
you think. Tell me if you can hear it. I'm gonna play it now. Oh, there it is. I don't
Wow.
know if that was coming through clearly from
Wow,
your
yeah,
end.
great. Very sophisticated. The instrumentation is fantastic.
Thank you. Thank
Yeah,
you.
really, really. I love the way you keep the balance very clear and leveled evenly, and nothing is going awkward. No, you keep them, and at the same time, every line gets its own importance. You see? So Usually, if you ask someone to interpret, they create background to the line. So
Yes.
this line, and then I create background, and that is the ordinary thing. But I the way you handle this is gorgeous. Yeah, like this is a composition of Robert Bishara that is that has the smell and the heritage that we're talking about, so you
Yes.
can feel it. The outfit is gorgeous that you're wearing this this line.
But it's like how I hear it, like that's how I heard it inside my mind, and trying to capture that, right? And that's the beauty of music, is if you can capture those ideas and feelings, right? So I want to thank you for your time, and I appreciate you spending some time with us to talk about, you know, your music, your life, your passion for music. So thank you so much.
All right, Robert. So thank you very much for having me in this very special interview. And I hope to one day maybe we can get together somewhere on Earth.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I wish.